Domestic convenience items aside, it was the decor that impressed him the most. The villagers had put a lot of effort into fashioning their homes according to individual taste. Many of the frames were carved, then painted or bound with willow wool in vibrant primary colors to emphasize curves and textures. Carvings invariably followed the Hindu or Buddhist school, with many armed gods and goddesses serenely contemplating the village as they sat astride powerful serpentine dragons. Inside the houses, mood decoration was favored, with children's playrooms formed inside nests of brash, exciting patterns. Lounges came in elegant abstracts or classical ornate, making them cozy and welcoming. Bedrooms in cool, subtly blended pastels. He began to wonder how many of the villagers were artisans. Somebody had to take care of the practical stuff. Spaced among the houses were carpentry shops where the furniture was fabricated, along with the trusses and internal structure for the A-frames. There was a pottery as well. Another craft shop made jewelry. Lawrence found that one easily enough. Skins clustered around it like bees swarming over their queen. Few of the pieces were made from gold or silver or platinum, and none had precious gemstones, but the bracelets and necklace pendants and earrings were all beautiful, handcrafted with care and precision. Most of them had cavities to hold neurotronic pearls. They were all being stuffed into skin pouches. Liot held court with the village council in what passed for the meeting place, a pavilion created from 10 big snowbark trees planted in a circle, their upper branches closely interlaced to form a broad dome of contiguous leaves that admitted slender ultramarine sunbeams while remaining closed against the rain. The captain was alarmed at the lack of anything valuable enough to qualify as a valid asset. The village did have a doctor, but a quick search of her surgery produced only 5 or 6 packets of medicines, all close to their expiration date. As in Stanlake, all serious accidents and illnesses were immediately shipped down to Dixon or on to Memu Bay. When Liot asked how many people lived in the village, the council said about 600. That was a lot more than the file from Memu Bay's town hall indicated. Even so, there weren't enough A-frames to house them all. "Because many of us live out in the forest where we gather the webs," the council replied. Directions to such homesteads were not given by grid reference. They were in the form of, "Walk half a kilometer along the northwest path, take a right-hand turn and walk for another kilometer, then ford the stream and head for the second peak to the south." Lawrence was pretty sure the villagers were quietly making fun of the captain, but he had to admit this kind of community was unlikely to have anything ZB could want. Like Dixon's aluminum ingots, sweaters, however colorful, were not a viable starship cargo. The captain decided to send Platoon 435 NK9 out to the wool center to check on the technology level employed. As it was a little way outside the village, he called for guides. In spite of the now blatant looting that was going on in the A-frame houses and craft workshops, the group of villagers accompanying them remained cheerful and polite. When their great-grandparents first settled this area, they told the skins, they had brought bulldozers and concrete and dammed one of the larger streams fed by the snowfields on Mount Henkin high above. A hydro plant built into the base of the dam provided the village and the wool center with all the electricity they needed. Their own small tool shop could fabricate any replacements for the hydro system, making them almost self-sufficient. The wool center was history with a vengeance for Lawrence. 5 airy wooden barns filled with old-fashioned machinery, busily whirring away. Piles of big willow webs were being combed out and spun into yarn. Dyeing bats bubbled away. Bobbin winders clattered. When it was compacted into strands and knitted together, willow wool made excellent water-resistant clothing. A fleet of small vans took the sweaters and ponchos and blankets down to Memu Bay, coming back with food and consumer goods. Unlike the aluminum trucks from Dixon, they'd continued making the run after the starships arrived. When he looked at a few of the sweaters coming off the knitting machines, Lawrence thought the patterns were conservative, nothing like as bold as the ones Jackie designed. 3 of the skins draped sweaters around their shoulders. Lawrence didn't bother. He was scanning the area, still suspicious. The whole village idol setup was just a little too perfect. "Where does that path lead?" he asked one of the villagers. Where the road to the village headed off from the wool center, a small footpath disappeared into the forest. "Just to the lake. It is well used." His sensors were showing him multiple overlapping footprints in the drying mud, and the smaller branches of undergrowth on either side were cut back. "What have you got, Lawrence?" Kibo asked. "Path to the lake," he says. "What's at the lake?" Kibo asked the villager. Lawrence watched the slight smile form, then vanish on the man's face. He was going to say water, Lawrence knew. "There is a temple at the lake, that's all." "A temple?" Kibo asked. "What sort of temple?" "It is a place of tranquility, where one goes to meditate in solitude." Kibo conferred with Intoko for a minute. "Okay, let's go check it out," the sergeant said.
"As you wish."
The villager's name was Duane Garcia. He was in his late 40s with thick, curly black hair and a slightly rounded face to which a smile came easily. He was healthy and fit-looking, in that way all people who led and relished outdoor lives appeared to be. Thinking back, Lawrence hadn't yet seen a villager who lacked vitality. Even the elderly ones seemed unrestricted by their age, while the little kids were like a gang of unruly miniature angels. It started raining heavily as the four skins and two villagers trudged down the path. Mud splattered Lawrence's legs up to his crotch. The droplets messed up half of his helmet sensors, producing blurred visual images. Duane Garcia pulled his sweater's hood up over his head and whistled happily. "Who's this temple dedicated to?" Kibo asked. "We don't worship gods," Duane said. "The universe is a natural phenomenon."
"Amen to that," Lawrence said.
"So why the temple?" Kibo persisted. "It's not a temple in the standard sense. We call it that because the architecture is a homage to some of Earth's historic buildings. The man who designed and built it was a good friend of my grandfather. Apparently he was quite upset when people started calling it the temple." They topped a small rise, and the forest fell away along with the ground. Beneath them was an alarmingly steep slope that led down into a heavily forested little valley. It was vistas like this that gave rise to the notion of Shangri-La, and Lawrence could well understand why. Mount Kenzie, the second largest of the Mitchell Peaks, stood guard at the far end, a tremendous rugged wall of rock whose upper reaches were cloaked in a thick layer of snow. Below the frost line, waterfalls tumbled hundreds of meters down its sides to vanish into the upper strata of forest with a continuous explosion of white spray englobed by rainbows. The valley itself was the gulf between two of Kenzie's buttress-like foothills, with a river running its length. Tributaries slithered along the base of every crease in the land. Directly below where they stood was a perfectly circular crater lake that had bitten slightly into the northern wall, resulting in a crescent cliff. A small island rose out of the center, like the back of some slumbering marine giant. At its highest, it could only have been a few meters above the surface of the lake. A few trees grew around the edges, their sun-bleached roots struggling for purchase among the boulders. There was a simple structure in the middle of the island, five columns of black and white fluted marble that supported a wide-arched stone roof. Underneath it were two tiers of circular stone seating that could probably hold about 20 people. The whole thing did look distinctly Hellenistic. A gravel path led away from it to a small wooden jetty. An identical jetty had been constructed on the shore of the lake opposite. A rowboat was tied up to the end.
"That's it?" Intoko asked.
"Yes,"
Duane Garcia said. The sergeant scanned his helmet sensors around. The path in front of them switchbacked down the risky slope. In several places where the drop was sheer, the villagers had built handrails. 70 meters below, the path wound into the dense forest again to emerge by the jetty.
"Okay, we've seen enough."
Intoko turned around and started walking back to the wool center. The other skins went with him. Lawrence remained on the top of the ridge. He still had that feeling that the villagers were having them on somehow. The rain was easing off now, boisterous clouds rolling away to the south, retreating from Mount Kenzie's imposing bulk. He requested a full-spectrum sensor sweep from his suit AS and targeted the temple. Nothing registered. There was no electromagnetic activity down there. No heat. It was just inert stone. Large gray and white birds flapped sedately through the air, their reflections keeping pace on the still black water. Hell. As his sensors shifted their focus back, he was mildly surprised to see Duane Garcia was still waiting for him. Checking on me? Certainly not. It's a difficult path back, and there are several forks. We wouldn't want you to get lost. Lawrence chuckled as they started walking. Funny, I'd have said that was exactly what you wanted to happen. Duane Garcia acknowledged the jibe with a slight grin. I admit your arrival here is not the most welcome visit we've ever had, but I really don't want you having a genuine accident out here, if for no other reason than I doubt your commanding officer would believe it was an accident. True enough. Can I ask you something? Certainly. Where's your jail? A jail? I'm sorry, we don't have one. So in a settlement of at least 600 people, there are no sinners. Sounds like paradise. I'm afraid not. We do have miscreants, of course. Every community does. It's just that we don't believe in incarceration as a form of correction or punishment. Other penalties are applied. Restrictions, both physical and material. For the record, I don't believe all this Zen bullshit you people are selling the captain. The whole community is way too nice. Normally, by the third generation, any community founded around a single principle has developed a lot of dissenting voices. You have seen the way we live. There is little here to complain about. And if you do, you are free to leave. Nope, I still don't buy it. You're very adamant about that. Why? I was born a third-generation colonist myself. I know all about the resentment directed toward obsolete restrictive ideals. That might just be you. Or perhaps our ideals are more appealing than those of your home world. Touché. But I still know you're hiding something, he thought. Captain Leote decided that it was safe for the patrol to stay in the village for the night. The villagers clearly didn't represent the kind of threat evident in Dixon. Families were temporarily evicted from various A-frame houses to make way for the squaddies. Lawrence was billeted with Intoco, Amersey, and 435 NK-9's latest recruit, Nick Fuccio. Their A-frame was one of those overlooking the Central Park where the convoy vehicles were drawn up. 5 comfortable bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, a lounge, study, reception room, dining kitchen, a family room full of toys, all arranged in a T-shape. As he walked through it, Lawrence thought about some middle managers from ZB he knew, whose apartments were a lot more cramped. He claimed a bedroom with a big sliding glass door and stripped off his skin. The bulky suitcase of field support equipment extruded 8 umbilical cords, and he plugged them into the suit. Blood and other fluids began to cycle through the flaccid synthetic muscle. A warm shower washed off the blue dermalese gel, and he dressed in an olive green sweatshirt and gray shorts to join his housemates on the balcony. Amersey had already found the drinks cabinet and mixed a jug of some lemon-based cocktail. Lawrence went for a can of Blue Saucer. The beer tasted better than it ever had down in Mimu Bay. He hadn't realized it before, but the village was situated on a gentle slope. Half of their A-frame was supported on thick wooden stilts to keep it level. From the balcony, they could see out over a broad, shallow valley where the forest formed an unbroken, dark, blue-green cloak. "Do we ever get any runaways, Sarge?" Nick asked as he settled back in a cushioned sun lounger. "No, we're too obvious. Why, are you thinking of it?" Nick gestured round the clearing. 8 of the convoy's squaddies remained in skin, guarding the trucks and jeeps. It was an easy duty. The kids were hanging around the vehicles, with the skins letting them sit in the driving seats. Several girls had appeared in their teens or early 20s. Lawrence was sure they hadn't been around before. He would have remembered. Like the tourists at Mimu Bay, they didn't wear much, T-shirts or halter tops and shorts. From his angle, most of them looked cute to beautiful. They belonged perfectly to the idol image. The duty skins were very busy talking to them.
"Got to admit," Nick said, "it's tempting. I can see myself living like this once I've earned a big enough stake."
"I couldn't," Lawrence said.
"Why the hell not? A place like this, you've got everything you could possibly need. Hey, I wonder if they go in for that tri-marriage lark. Country folk always stick with the original traditions longer than the townies."
Intoco chuckled and pushed his cocktail glass toward the tall, healthy girls gathered round the jeep.
"Two of them together would finish you off, man."
"There are worse ways to go. This whole living with nature in the forest crap is a dead end," Lawrence said.
"Whoa there, the man's got a bug jammed up his ass," Nick laughed.
"What could be wrong with this, Lawrence? Do a couple of hours work each day, then spend the rest of the time lying about drinking and screwing. Look at 'em. They're all smiling. None of them are stressed. They know they're onto a good thing."
"I've seen this kind of setup before. It appeals to us because we see it as a break from our job. But you can't live like this for 80 years. You'd die of boredom after 6 months."
"Ah, hell," Amorcy groaned. "Here we go. The starship captain speech again. We're all meant for higher things."
"It's true," Lawrence insisted. "This kind of existence contributes nothing to the human experience. It's a retreat for people who can't handle modern society. And the irony is, they're utterly dependent on that society. Villages like this rely entirely on the industrial products made down in the city."
"That's always been the way, Lawrence," Intoco said. "Different communities live different lives and produce different things. Trading between them generates wealth. Centuries ago, it was different nations. Now we've evolved microcosms of that, with communities that are going down highly specialized routes. This kind of lifestyle wasn't possible before modern communications and transport. These villagers are as much a development of our society as Memu Bay is.
They're dreamers who need a good dose of reality to wake up and take part in what the rest of us are building."
The sergeant raised his cut crystal glass to the sinking sun.
"Well, this is the kind of dreaming I like. Now have yourself another beer and chill out, Lawrence."
"Yes, Sarge." Lawrence grinned and fished round in the icebox. A group of children walked past the end of the house's garden. They yelled something unintelligible, and Lawrence waved back. Places like this, he conceded, did have their uses. He'd never managed to relax quite this much before on Thal Spring, not even clubbing down on the marina. If he could just work out what was wrong with Arun, which was when he saw one of the children, a boy, slip his hand into one of the bushes that marked the boundary of the garden. His fingers slithered casually through the chubby blue-green leaves and found one of the fruits hanging within. It was a smallish globe with a satin-orange sheen. He plucked it with an easy twist of his hand and bit into it. Juice dribbled down his chin.
"I knew it," Lawrence hissed. "Did you see that?"
"See what?" Intoco asked.
"He's eating fruit, real fruit, off a bush. They're all bloody regressors."
Intoco frowned at the boy over the rim of his glass.
"You sure?"
"I saw him. Filthy habit. Fancy making your kids do that." Nick pulled a face at the liquid slopping around the bottom of his own glass.
"Hey, you don't think they've given us any, do you?"
"They'd better not have," Amorcy growled. Lawrence slumped back down in the sun lounger again. He felt a lot happier now that he'd discovered the village's dirty little secret. I knew nothing was this perfect. The fridge in the A-frame's kitchen had been filled with food ready for them to cook. He made a mental note to check the packaging that tonight's meal came out of. Thank fate there weren't any animals grazing around the A-frames. At least the villagers weren't that twisted. They ate out on the balcony, microwaving pork barbecue ribs and baked potatoes. Nick even mixed a couple of Tex-Mex sauces from some sachets he found. Each of the packets had unbroken Memu Bay food refinery seals. Dessert was double chocolate chip ice cream. They sat in the loungers, watching the sun going down behind the huge mountains. The village was dipped in shadow from late afternoon onward. Twilight lasted at least a couple of hours, silhouetting the peaks against a luminous amethyst and gold sky. Stars began to shine early on, twinkling brightly through the cold, thin air above the mountains. Eventually, the Milky Way blazed like a fat comet's tail across the night. Lawrence wasn't really drunk when he went to bed, although he'd had just enough beer to keep his thoughts buzzing. He slept fitfully, waking up every few minutes to twist and turn, thumping his pillow. About 1 o'clock in the morning, he heard the scream. It was cut off almost immediately. For a moment, he thought it might have been the confused end to some dream, except he thought he'd been awake now for a quarter of an hour. He lay there, wide awake, alert. It had been a female scream, he was sure of that. Now that he concentrated, he could hear some kind of scuffling, footsteps on wooden stairs, another cry, muffled this time. Lawrence came off the bed fast, snatching up a pair of interface glasses. He slipped them on and told his bracelet pearl to give him their light amplification function. The glasses didn't have a particularly advanced capability, certainly nothing like his skin sensors, but they showed him the darkened bedroom, pulling it into focus with sparkling blue and gray tones. He slid the broad patio door open and went outside onto the veranda. His room was facing away from the village clearing, looking along the line of A-frames. Stars glared down on the village, banishing shadows. A girl, maybe 8 or 10 years old, was running around between the A-frames. She was barefoot, wearing only a baggy white nightshirt. Her legs and knees were streaked with mud and grass moss juice. He could see tears streaming down her cheeks.
"Jacintha,"
she called, then sobbed again.
"Jacintha, please, where are you? Jacintha."
Lawrence jogged down the narrow steps from his veranda, asking fate that Jacintha was her cat or some other pet. The girl saw him coming and cowered back.
"Please don't hurt me. Please."
Caught in the silver rain of starlight, she looked just like his sister, Janice. She must be 21. Fate, no, 22 now. I wonder what she's doing. He held his hands out toward the little girl. "It's okay. Nobody's going to hurt you. I just want to know what's going on. Can you tell me?" She took a couple of paces away from him.
"Nothing. Nothing's happening."
"Well, now, I'm not so sure. I heard a shout. Was that Jacintha?"
"I don't know."
"Listen, I'm called Lawrence. Can you tell me your name?" She sniffled loudly.
"Denise."
"Okay, Denise. That's a nice name. So are you going to tell me who Jacintha is?" He was looking around, trying to spot any motion in the village. Several A-frames still had their lights on. He could see the windows glowing around the edges of the curtains as if they'd been bordered in neon. The convoy vehicles were dark outlines in the middle of the clearing. He could see a couple of skins standing guard. The fact that they weren't showing any interest in him and the girl made him edgy.
"She's my sister," Denise said.
"Okay. How old is she?"
17.
Lawrence swore under his breath. He had a pretty good idea of what was happening now. Damn Captain Leote for his lack of discipline, and damn ZB-2 for employing lowlifes as its squatties.
"Tell me, Denise, did somebody take her away?"
"Yes,"
Denise said meekly.
"We were all sleeping together in Paula's home."
She pointed at one of the A-frames. Lawrence could see several young faces pressed against one of its windows, staring out at him.
"Go on." "Two of you came and said they wanted to ask her some questions, that it was about state security. They said she had to go with him."
"Where? Did you see where they all went?"
"Not really. It was this way, though."
She was pointing along the row of houses, and the scream he'd heard must have been fairly close. "Were they in skin? You know, the big dark suits?"
"No."
"Good." Lawrence started running in the direction she was pointing. "Now you just wait here."
Denise hesitated, her lips quaking.
"You'll be fine." Indigo script scrolled down his glasses, giving him the convoy's current security status. It was level 7, no alerts or irregularities. He told his bracelet pearl to open a link to Intoko and wake him. There was no light on anywhere inside the first A-frame as he ran past. The second A-frame had one window illuminated.
Lawrence dashed up onto the balcony. Three squatties were inside, sitting around a table playing cards. The third A-frame had a light on. Its curtains were shut tight. Lawrence took the balcony stairs two at a time, heedless of the slippery dew under his bare feet. He could hear a murmur of voices from inside, the tight, guttural syllables that came from harsh, expectant men. He pulled the wide patio door open and shoved the curtain aside. It was just as he was expecting. The girl, Jacinta, was lying on the floor, her long T-shirt pulled up round her neck, a pathetic, terrified expression on her face. Three squatties stood around her, Morteth, LaForth, and Kamir, all from platoon 482 NK3. LaForth already had his trousers off, exposing his erection. Standing between the girl's ankles, he was using his feet to shove her legs farther apart. All three of them turned to face Lawrence. Their shock and guilt twisted into relief when they realized it was one of their own. "Jesus, Newton," LaForth spat. "What the fuck is the matter with you?" "Close the goddamn door," Morteth said. Lawrence pushed his glasses up so that Jacinta could see his face. "Have they raped you?" he asked. She shook her head quickly. "No." Her voice was almost a squeak. "Okay, come with me." He held a hand out and beckoned. Kamir stepped between Lawrence and Jacinta, put his hands on his hips, and smiled challengingly. "This is our prisoner, Newton. Now either join in or fuck off." Lawrence could smell the liquor on his breath. "Don't you get it, fuckhead? This is over. Finished, understand?" "How can this be over? We haven't started yet, buddy." "You're not going to start. We're not here for this." He moved to one side. Jacinta was still lying on the floor, staring around uncertainly. LaForth was equally doubtful now. He glanced at Morteth, who was glaring at Lawrence. Jacinta managed to sit up and pull her T-shirt down over her breasts. "Come on." Once again, Lawrence put his hand out for her. Kamir pushed it aside. "Get the fuck out of here, or I'll see to it that you're this terrorist's first victim." Lawrence bent forward as if he were reaching for Jacinta. As he expected, Kamir went for a kick to the back of his knee. He spun easily and caught Kamir's foot as the kick went wide, pushing up hard. Kamir yelled as his foot was propelled toward the ceiling, sending him toppling backward. Morteth roared, lunging at Lawrence, arms outstretched. Lawrence stepped inside the bear hug and nutted him. The roar was cut off by the sound of bone snapping. Blood squirted out of Morteth's nose. Jacinta screamed. LaForth's fist caught Lawrence just to the left of his sternum. He stumbled back from the impact of the blow, catching sight of Kamir coming at him. This time he went for the bear hug. A good move, but he didn't quite manage to pull it off. Kamir predicted him, chopped at his right arm, finding the dead spot perfectly. Lawrence howled at the pain, but kept on pushing, using his momentum to take the two of them into the flapping curtain. It tore free from the rail in a storm of brass rings, and they crashed into the balcony with a thick fabric wrapping round them. Kamir kicked out. Lawrence kicked back. Without shoes, he had little impact on the other man. The two of them wrestled around for a moment, but with Lawrence's right arm still useless, Kamir quickly managed to get on top. Lawrence's knee hit him in the back of his neck. He flopped away just as LaForth caught hold of Lawrence's leg, twisting hard. Lawrence went with the turn, bringing his other leg round to thud into the man's ribs. LaForth fell over, his inertia taking both of them down the stairs. It was a bad descent, and there was very little Lawrence could do to slow it, not while he was tangled with LaForth. Elbows and knees managed to hit just about every step on the way as they tumbled. His head caught a glancing blow as well, which more than doubled the number of visible stairs. They crashed onto the muddy moss grass and broke apart. Lawrence was aware of several people approaching at a run. Half of them were children. The others were adults from the village. He couldn't see any of his platoon. Jacinta was still screaming, and light from the patio doors was splashing across the A-frame's garden where they'd landed. The whole village must have been attracted by the commotion. It didn't bother LaForth, who aimed a kick at him. Lawrence rolled aside easily and swung a punch. His accuracy wasn't too good, with the pain distracting him. LaForth half-ducked, receiving the blow on his shoulder, and tried to tackle Lawrence. As he closed in, Lawrence kneed him in the jaw, sending his head snapping back.
Lawrence grinned down with savage satisfaction as LaForth fell heavily, barely conscious. Then Camere landed on his back, and they both collapsed onto the damp moss grass beside LaForth.
"That's him," Denise yelled. "That's the man."
"Great," Lawrence thought as he blocked Camere's chop to his Adam's apple. "They'll think I'm the rapist."
"They're like savages," a man's voice called out. "Stop them," Denise cried. "Stop them, they're hurting him."
"Jacintha? Jacintha, where are you?" Camere kicked Lawrence in the ribs, flipping him over. He rolled twice and crouched. Charged at Camere, sending them both sprawling again.
"Stop it," Denise yelled. "Please, someone."
"Jacintha?"
"Father, father, I'm here."
"Jacintha?"
"Call the dragon," Denise said. "It'll make them stop."
"No, child." "Are you all right, Jacintha? Did they harm you?"
"Stop it, stop it." "I'm all right, father."
With Camere pressed against him, hands clawing wildly, there was little Lawrence could do except claw back. The worst kind of wrestling, two drunks writhing round in a gutter, legs scrabbled and jerked against each other as they rolled again and again.
"Oh, please," Denise wailed.
Brilliant white light stabbed down. Both Lawrence and Camere froze. Skin hands closed around them, pulling them apart forcefully.
"What the fuck is going on here?" Intoko demanded.
Lawrence wheezed down some air, happy to let the skin support him. He wasn't sure his own legs could do that right now, given how badly they were shaking. A lot of people had gathered, illuminated by skin helmet lights. Villagers clutching their children, squatties in shorts blinking sleep from their eyes. Still more villagers arriving.
"Well?" Intoko asked.
The girl," Lawrence gasped. "I heard a scream."
"Uh-huh."
Intoko glanced at Jacintha, who was in her father's arms while her mother and Denise clung to her.
"Shit," he murmured, and looked at Camere in the skin suit's hold. He was smeared in mud and blood.
LaForth was trying to climb to his feet, a painful process. Morteth stood on the balcony, one hand clamped over his nose, pinching the nostrils. His shirt was soaked scarlet by the astonishing amount of blood that had poured out of his mashed nose.
Intoko beckoned the duty skin sergeant over, and the two of them put their heads together.
Lawrence could hear the occasional murmur. The two sergeants faced the crowd.
"Okay, people, that's it for tonight," Intoko said. "You three."
And his finger stabbed out at Morteth, LaForth, and Camere. "Back into your billet, where you will remain until 0700 hours. Travers, you have sentry duty. If they come out here before the designated hour, you are authorized to use maximum force."
"Sir,"
one of the skins saluted. Intoko went over to Jacintha and her family.
"Ma'am, do you require medical assistance?"
"No,"
her father said. His arm had tightened around her.
"Not from you."
Jacintha gave a miserable nod of confirmation. "Very well. Could you please return to your house for the rest of the night? And I can assure you there won't be a repeat of this incident."
"Thank you."
Lawrence was impressed by the way such a simple phrase could be made to project so much derision. The skin holding Lawrence handed him over to Nick and Amorcy. The two of them had to give him plenty of support as he limped back to their A-frame. Everyone else was heading back to bed, talking in low tones. Denise suddenly appeared in front of Lawrence. She smiled up shyly.
"Thanks."
She raced away back to her family before he could say anything.
Nick laughed. "Got yourself a new girlfriend, Lawrence. A looker, huh?"
"Give me a fucking break." Intoko appeared where Denise had been a moment before. He wasn't smiling.
"What the fuck do you think you're doing, man? You want to be a hero, do it on the company's time."
"Come on, Sarge, like you'd play it differently. I would have got me some backup. Don't you learn anything in training?"
"I called you."
"Jesus." They arrived at their A-frame and went up the stairs to the balcony. Lawrence had to grip the handrail. Now that the adrenaline and endorphins were wearing off, he seemed to hurt everywhere. As soon as he was in the lounge, he fell into the sofa.
"I need a drink."
Kibbo cracked a can of blue saucer and handed it to him.
Lawrence took a sip and decided that was just too macho.
Intoko sat beside him and opened up the first aid kit.
Hold still, hero. Despite the medicines, Lawrence was stiff everywhere when he woke the next morning. He took a hot shower, which eased things a bit. One ankle was badly swollen. Both legs were grazed. He had bruises everywhere. But Intoco had insisted that the injuries were all superficial. Nothing that gets you out of duty. He had breakfast with Nick and Amersey, who had a good time joshing him over the fight. The sergeant didn't eat with him. He'd left the A-frame while Lawrence was still in the shower. He arrived back as they were finishing the meal. "You two, get lost," he told Nick and Amersey. "So, what's happening about last night?" Lawrence asked. Intoco poured himself some coffee and sat down opposite Lawrence. "I've been talking to the captain about last night. He wants this shut down fast."
"What does that mean?"
"It means no righteous heroes kicking up a fuss when we get back to barracks."
"What are you saying, that those three get off free? They were going to gang rape a 17-year-old for fate's sake. I'm not eating that kind of shit sandwich."
"We all know what they were doing, and they're not getting away with it. But there are ways of dealing with situations like this where we don't all have to lose out."
"How?" Lawrence asked with deep suspicion.
"Okay, let's take it your way. Clean and honest, all our dirty laundry out there in public. Morteth, LaForth, and Khmer stand trial. They're guilty, obviously. They get shipped home under guard and serve their 15 years. Fair enough. But after the facts get read out in court, there's going to have to be an inquiry to find out why it happened."
"They're a bunch of drunken bastards. That's why it happened."
"Sure, but specifically, why didn't Leote have enough discipline over his men to prevent them even thinking about this? Why didn't 482 NK3 Sergeant stop what was going on? It's the NCOs who take the immediate blame, you know that. How come the skins on guard duty didn't see what was happening and step in?"
"They should have."
"I know, man, but things are damn slack around here. You've seen how everyone's been helping themselves to everything these poor old hillbillies have. Leote should have stepped in hard and fast right at the start, but he didn't because he wanted a quiet life. So it just keeps getting worse until those three assholes pull a stunt like last night's and land all of us up shit creek. If this ever gets on an official report, half of the convoy is going to have a reprimand on our files."
Lawrence drank some tea, which was getting colder than he liked.
"You mean if I do what's right and testify to the commander, I'll screw everyone else?" "Like I said, there are ways of dealing with this. Leote can operate through different channels if you let him."
"What sort of channels?"
"Okay, I'll lay this on the line for you. Say nothing, and you'll come out of this campaign with a commendation on your report that's better than anything you could get for saving the general's ass in full combat, and there'll be a stripe on your shoulder for sure. Morteth, LaForth, and Khmer will be quietly shitlisted once we get home. They'll be discharged or given latrine duty for the rest of their lives, and they certainly won't get any sort of campaign bonus. Neither will they get any kind of reference from ZB. Without that, no employer on the planet will touch them. It's the slammer without walls."
"And Leote gets himself out of this with a clean record?"
"Yeah, along with a whole bunch of other people who don't deserve a bad rap because he screwed up. And next time he'll know how to run a command properly."
"That's got to be worth something, Lawrence. You and I know we've got damn few decent officers."
"Don't, Sarge. Don't try and sell this by telling me I'm going to be improving that useless asshole."
"Okay, man, you look at it any way you want to. But it's your call, and you've got to make it now. This can't be ducked. And if it helps any, I'd have done the same thing last night. It was the right thing."
"Something you haven't mentioned."
"Yeah, what?"
"The girl, Jacinta. What about Jacinta?"
"What about her?"
"Three of ZB's finest tried to rape her."
"But they didn't rape her, did they? Thanks to the hero of the hour. She had a nasty shock, which is never going to be repeated because we're never coming back. She can get on with her lotus-eating life again. 6 months' time, we'll just be a bad memory fading away."
"That's it? She doesn't count?"
"This is politics, man. Her stake in this isn't as big as ours. So what's your decision?"
Lawrence grinned, even though the bruise on his lip hurt when he did it.
At least the sarge was being diplomatic.
pretending he even had a choice. He knew damn well if he carried this through and screwed Liotte and the other sergeants, he'd be the one who wound up shit-listed. That was the way the companies worked, the way they'd always worked, the way they always would work. He drank some more of his cold tea. I guess I must have got these bruises falling downstairs last night. Chapter 14. The court-martial was held in the banqueting suite of the Barnsdale Hotel, which was barracks to 8 of ZB's platoons and half of the Industrial Technology Corps. There was a dais at one end of the long room, normally used by a band. Today it had a single table with 3 chairs for the presiding officers, of which Ebrey Zhang was president of the court. Arranged below them on the dance floor were another 2 tables. One was occupied by the prosecution team, led by the ZB attorney, who was being supported by the Memu Bay police magistrate, Heather Fernandez, and 2 more high-powered legal assistants. The defense table had 2 chairs where Hal sat with Lieutenant Brelo. Behind them, 50 plastic chairs had been arranged in rows to seat ZB personnel, selected members of the public, and a few media representatives. The first row was reserved for the mayor and whoever he chose to have with him, a couple of old friends, Margaret Reese and Detective Galliani. 10 skins were standing guard around the room, being politely ignored by the civilian audience. For once, the power supply was uninterrupted, allowing the light cones to shine at full intensity. When Lawrence arrived, escorting Hal, he was disgusted by the waiting. The kid had taken one look at the layout and virtually cringed. "It's a fucking show trial," Lawrence growled at Brelo while Hal was distracted. The lieutenant answered with a slightly guilty shrug. Lawrence took a chair from the audience section and brought it up to the defense table. He sat on it and gave Hal a solid, reassuring pat on the knee. The kid responded with a pathetically grateful smile. Nobody remonstrated with Lawrence. He was wearing his full dress uniform, displaying more decorations than most of the officers in the room. If he wanted to stand by a squatty under his command, none of the NCOs helping with the court arrangements were going to stop him. Bryant saw where he was and glared before sitting with the other officers. The sergeant major called for silence. The presiding officers marched in and took their seats on the dais. Lawrence couldn't fault the procedure. Prosecution made its case well. The details of the case were explained to the court. Selective sections of various police interviews with Hal were also played. 20 minutes in, and already it looked bad. Detective Galliani was called to the stand and told the court about Hal's alibi, which the kid had stuck to the whole time. "Did you manage to trace the taxi that the defendant claims he took?" prosecution asked. "No, sir," Galliani answered. "The traffic regulator AS has no log of any taxi being used on that street at that time of night, and Mr. Grabowski was most insistent on the time he left the barracks. In fact, we pulled the logs for every taxi in Memu Bay that day. None of them were unaccounted for at either of the times when Mr. Grabowski said he was traveling to and from the alleged brothel." "Ah, yes," prosecution said smugly. "The brothel the defendant says he visited. Does it exist, detective?" "No, sir. Mr. Grabowski himself identified Minster Avenue as the street where this alleged brothel was situated. We investigated every house. They are all private residences." Lawrence had visited Minster Avenue himself 2 days ago. Not in skin, he wore civilian clothes, a shirt with a high collar to cover his valves. Before he went, he trawled images of the street from the town hall planning department and showed them to Hal, who'd pointed unhesitatingly to number 18. Standing outside the house, Lawrence took his time looking around. There was the neat little front garden with its wrought iron fence, just as Hal described. It guarded a squat white stone facade with big windows, the paintwork clean and bright. Like all the others along the street, a home for the upper middle class. Lawrence activated his bracelet pearl and called up his prime. A complex indigo image slid across his optronic membranes as the quasi-sentient program decompressed from its storage block. Perhaps it was his imagination, but it seemed brighter than the bracelet pearl's standard icons. He opened a link into Memo Bay's data pool and told the Prime to trawl the household AS and the local traffic logs. Information began to scroll up almost at once. Whatever software the Killboy Resistance Group used to cover their tracks, it was excellent, which strengthened his suspicions that they had compromised E-Alpha. Number 18's household AS told him nothing because it had been inactive for over a week. The system was still waiting repair. Smaller independent sections of the house's network were functioning on autonomous backup mode, but they didn't have memory logs. Strangest of all, the security system was also offline. Its sensors weren't even drawing power. Minster Avenue's road traffic logs confirmed there had been very few vehicles driving along the street during the night Hal claimed he'd visited. Certainly no taxi had pulled up outside number 18. But the Prime dug deeper into the local transport network. Between 1:48 and 2:10, the network data flow had increased by a small percentage after Hal had left. There was nothing in the logs to account for the increase. Shutting up shop, Lawrence muttered to himself. The minute data abnormality wouldn't convince a court that had Hal's DNA sample taken off the girl. He wasn't even sure it would be admissible in court, but it was good enough for him. An electronic graffiti roughly equivalent to spraying "Killboy was here" across the front of the house. Lawrence walked over the road and rang the brass bell. It took a minute before the black front door swung open. A woman in an apron stood in the hallway, giving him a suspicious stare. "Yes? Elena Melchett?" "Yes, who are you?" "Lawrence Newton. I'm covering the alien rape case." Elena Melchett didn't look as if she wanted to cooperate with the media. "So?" The alien suspect claims he was somewhere in this street when the incident happened. It's his alibi. I was wondering if you had seen anything." "Mr. Newton, that obscene crime took place at 1 o'clock in the morning. I was in bed, asleep. I certainly didn't see any alien thug hanging around outside." "I didn't think so. Thank you. He fished around in his pockets while Elena Melchett grew increasingly impatient. He found his media card and activated a visual file. "Sorry to be such a pain, but do you recognize this man?" The card's screen showed a picture of Hal. Elena Melchett studied it. "No." "Really? That's odd. What do you mean?" Lawrence told the card to switch to another file. "This is a blueprint of your hall, isn't it?" He peered past the woman at the big staircase that curved up to the second floor landing. This time, Elena Melchett barely glanced at the image. "It's similar. I'd say it's identical, even down to the marble tiling." "What do you want, Mr. Newton?" "That alien suspect, he put this image together with an architect program. How would he know what your hallway looked like if he'd never been here? You did say you didn't recognize him, didn't you?" "Get out," Elena Melchett ordered him in a strident voice. "Out and don't come back. If I see you around here again, I'll call the police." The glossy door slammed shut. The prosecution had got Hal up on the witness stand. Lawrence could finally appreciate the saying about someone being his own worst enemy. It wasn't going well. In fact, it was excruciating just being in the same room. The prosecution wanted to know why he'd jumped curfew. Hal, good old, honest, fresh from the farm Hal, said he did it because he was desperate for sex. The prosecution wanted to know where he'd gone that night to hunt for sex. Hal told them the brothel on Minster Avenue, doggedly sticking to his version of events. Lawrence presumed it was because his mother had always told him to tell the truth. The prosecution tore that version of the fateful night to shreds, and there wasn't any evidence that Lieutenant Brelo could produce to back Hal up. Then they went on to ask about the genetic samples. Hal claimed the girl was a whore, and that the rest of it, the rape allegation, the non-existent brothel, was all a setup by Killboy. It didn't go down well. Francine Hazeldine's haunting statement had already been played back to the court. Lawrence had watched the presiding officers as her fragile voice had described what happened that night, detail by agonizing detail.
The more the farce carried on, the more Lawrence admired Kilboy's strategy and resourcefulness, and the more angry he became. Hal was just too easy. He wanted to stand up in the banqueting suite and face the locals, asking, "Why don't you try this one with me?" But then the devastating effect that the trial would have on ZB's morale was the final triumph of that elegant strategy. He was also haunted by the terrible specter of responsibility. There should have been a trial very similar to this last time he was on Thall Spring. The fact that it had never happened was in no small part due to him. Justice then had been circumvented rather than served. Now justice was coming back to strike them with a vengeance. Lawrence spent most of the time wondering if the two could possibly be connected. Only by a god with a very twisted sense of humor, he decided. After 5 hours of testimony and witness examination, the presiding officers recessed the court so they might consider their verdict. They took 90 minutes, which Lawrence thought was a diplomatic enough length of time, given that they'd already decided that verdict before the court-martial even began. Hal stood in front of the dais facing the presiding officers, his shoulders squared as every Zhang announced the findings. On the charge of disobeying a direct order and breaking curfew, guilty. On the charge of misleading the local police, guilty. On the charge of assault and rape of a minor, guilty. "No," Hal yelled, incensed. "I'm not." There was a sigh from the audience, not of jubilation, but a shared sense of justice and victory. Against all the odds, they'd been given the right outcome. Hal sat down again while Lieutenant Brelo gave what Lawrence had to acknowledge was an eloquent plea for clemency. Then everyone stood for the sentence. A very troubled-looking Ebrey Zhang said, "Halford Grabowski, given the grave nature of this abominable crime, we find we have no alternative but to impose the most severe sentence it is within this court's power to issue. You are hereby sentenced to death." Hal Grabowski went berserk. He screamed obscenities at the presiding officers and started to run for the door. Anyone who got in his way was felled with powerful punches from his hulking frame. The audience scrambled for safety, also screaming. It took two skins to hold on to the enraged squatty and administer a sedative. His unconscious body was dragged out of the banqueting suite. Ebrey Zhang straightened his uniform and cleared his throat. "Sentence to be carried out at dawn the day after tomorrow. Leave to appeal is denied. Lieutenant Brelo, please inform your client of the outcome. This court is now concluded." The presiding officers filed out. Lawrence didn't move. Brelo turned to him and said, "I really am sorry. He didn't deserve this." As he didn't get an answer, he nodded nervously and hurried out. The audience was lining up at the doors at the rear to get out and back to their town and their lives. It wasn't long before everyone else had left. Amersey and the remaining members of 435 NK9 lined up in front of the defense counsel table. Lawrence looked at them one by one. "If anybody wants to stick with Xantiu Braun, you'd better leave now." A couple of them snorted in derision. The rest simply waited expectantly for their sarge to tell them what to do next. "Okay," Lawrence said. "Time for us to start playing unfair." This time, Joseph drove a car out to the spaceport. He arrived in the middle of the afternoon and passed through the main gate with the identity of Andel Pine, a junior manager with the catering company that had the franchise for the administration block. The spaceport's general management AS assigned his car a slot in Park 7. Because of Andel Pine's somewhat lowly status, he had a long walk back to the block itself. He carried a slim briefcase with him, de rigueur for management of any level. Sunglasses were also obligatory, so he wore a cheap plastic pair. His light green one-piece coverall wasn't quite regular, but it had the catering company logo on its breast pocket. He had boots rather than shoes. All in all, his appearance was well inside the permissible norm. Ahead of him, the afternoon sun shone on a five-sided structure with slightly convex walls of darkened glass.
From where he was, the administration block resembled a closed-up tulip flower with a blunt tip. It stood by itself to one end of the terminal building, away from the much taller control tower. Although the building was only 5 stories high, the architect's plans that his prime had trawled out of the data pool showed a service level and another 5 floors below ground. When he reached the main entrance, he had to repeat the whole security identification procedure, allowing the AS to check his palm and facial pattern. Security in general was a lot tighter in the administration block than the main terminal, thanks to all the ZB staff that worked there now. Inside, he ignored the reception desk and the 2 skins standing beside it, walking directly to the bank of elevators in the central lobby. No one who came in on a regular basis would be intimidated or even concerned by them anymore. He took an elevator down to the 1st sublevel, where building maintenance had its offices, along with the canteen. So far, everything matched the floor plan and security camera images they'd trawled. Joseph went into the toilets and claimed an empty cubicle. The AS logged him through a security camera. Coverage inside the administration block was almost universal, with only places like the toilet cubicles free of cameras. Not that their absence mattered. The AS followed everyone's position constantly. You couldn't trade places or switch with anybody else. It was Andal Pine who went into the cubicle. If anyone else came out, the AS would sound the alarm. It wasn't the AS that Joseph was trying to avoid. He simply needed time to make a few alterations. At this stage, sharp-eyed humans were his greatest worry. His prime went into the administration block's network and began editing the monitor logs. The AS soon registered that it was Sket Magerson who was in the cubicle. Once the switch of electronic records was complete, Joseph stood still and concentrated. The D-written organelles deep inside his cells quickened and began to modify his flesh. Facial skin pigmentation darkened slightly. Features started to morph. The tip of his nose broadened out while the nostrils widened. Lips fattened up. His cheeks sagged slightly, then stiffened, giving the impression of a flatter jawbone. Irises became a light hazel. There was a small vanity mirror in his briefcase. Joseph took it out and examined his rearranged face. They'd spent a long time observing Sket Magerson as the ZB space plane pilot drank in Durrell's bars and ate in its restaurants. He'd been chosen because he was similar in height, weight, age, and general profile, so Joseph's D-written systems would be able to imitate his physical appearance without too much trouble. His voice was deeper than Joseph's, and his accent was pure Cape Town. But a direct link with a neurotronic pearl running a vocal synthesizer program took care of that. Joseph even had the man's walk down pat. His shoulders had a lavish swing when he hurried. The image in the mirror was that of Sket. Nodding in satisfaction, Joseph stripped off his green one-piece and reversed it. This way round, it was a standard dark gray ZB pilot's flight suit, complete with insignia, baggy leg pants, and elastic waist. Joseph stepped out of the cubicle and took his time washing his hands, making sure the toilet's security camera could see him clearly. The prime monitored the security AS, but there was no caution alert issued. He went back to the elevators and descended to sublevel 5. Simon Roderick had decided on the simplest system possible to monitor the key vault. Keep electronics to an absolute minimum and rely on human observers. That distrust of electronics extended to not informing the spaceport security AS that a covert operation was being mounted. They didn't even tell the local security staff. According to the administration block records, the office on sublevel 4 was assigned to Kwan and Rains, who were 3rd Fleet Quartermaster staff. They were the ones in charge of spare parts being shipped down from the starships to keep the Xiantis flying, working with their own AS to keep expenditure to the lowest level possible. Even the data that flowed into the office from local networks supported their assignment, although it did contain a large amount of information not directly applicable, such as staff schedules and flight profiles. Typical bloatware overload. Simon occupied the office next to theirs. The AS had him listed as a spaceplane avionics systems manager, a title that could be confirmed by the number of boxes and small packages that kept getting taken inside, all of them labeled with electronics department barcodes. The only thing missing from the two offices was a security camera. Simon wasn't going to risk the opposition being able to spy on his own spies. They'd set up the first office as an observation center. One wall was now covered in sheet screens, relaying various scenes from the administration block. Each one was connected to a single fixed-position lens via fiber optic cable. Picture quality was well down on standard sensors, but this way there was no electrical cabling. A power flow, however small, could always be detected. The screens even had their own independent power supply, a bank of cells in one corner. That way there was no drain on the administration block circuits, which could be tracked through the data pool. Adul Kwan watched the elevator doors open on sub-level 5. A man in a ZV flight uniform walked out. "Who've we got here?" Adul grunted. Procedure was to confirm everybody who arrived on sub-level 5. The screen feed was linked to a desktop Perl that had no connection to the local network. Instead, it was loaded with personnel files. Whoever the new arrival was, he walked right underneath the lens covering the elevators. "Scott Magerson," Braddock read off the card's display. "1 minute." He was frowning as he riffled through a stack of hard copy. Both he and Adul had privately bitched about Simon Roderick insisting on keeping printed records. But their chief was convinced that E-Alpha had been compromised, leaving their data memories wide open to manipulation. So every morning the spaceport's personnel schedules were printed out. This way they could check who was supposed to be in the administration block and who was suspect. Braddock glanced down Magerson's sheet, stopped, and read it carefully. Shit. He's supposed to be on leave today. Spent the last 5 days flying. Adul straightened up and peered at the other screens covering sub-level 5. So what's he doing here and down at that level? Good question. Braddock went to stand beside his colleague. They watched Magerson walk along a corridor, nodding affably to people. Heading toward the vault, Adul said in a low, excited tone. That's not certain. Bullshit. Adul was on the edge of his seat. Magerson had arrived at the communications department. He gave the security sensor a code word and put his hand over the scanner. His voice print and blood vessel pattern must have matched. The door slid open. Sir. Braddock was heading for their office's connecting door. He opened it hurriedly. Sir, I think we have something. There were three offices making up the communications department, linked by a short corridor. Security cameras confirmed that, as usual, there were only two people inside, one in the first office, one in the third. When the outer door opened, Joseph slipped in and waited for it to shut. Prime edited him out of the security camera's vision. Neither of the two ZB officers inside the department had heard the door. He paused for a second, then ordered his Prime to call the man in the first office. It was a query from the maintenance division about a glitch in a space plane satellite tracking unit with the quasi-sentient program generating the supervisor's image and voice. When the communications officer started to answer, Joseph walked quickly past the office and went into the second. His Prime disabled three alarm sensors that were triggered by his entry. He shut the door and locked it with a manual bolt, then drew a quiet breath as he waited to see if either of the officers had reacted. Images from the security cameras hung behind his eyes, showing both of them at work behind their desks. The key vault had a big steel door reinforced by boron long-chain fiber. Before ZB arrived, it had stored the gold and platinum used in the Micro-G manufacture of electronic components. Now the metal had been shipped up to the starships, leaving a lot of empty space for ZB to store its keys. There were two locks that worked on deep-scanned hand patterns. They had to be activated simultaneously by two different people. Joseph took a pair of slim dragon-extruded modules from his trouser leg pockets and applied the first one over the top lock. Its surface undulated slowly as it melded itself to the scanner. The second module went over the bottom lock. He activated them together, and the magnetic bolts snapped out with a clunk, loud enough to make Joseph flinch.
He pulled at the heavy door, swinging it back. The vault was a cube, measuring 8 meters along each side. Bright lights came on in the ceiling as he walked in. The walls were lined by metal grid shelves. A single metal table stood in the center. There were 15 black plastic cases stacked up on the shelving, 75 centimeters long, 15 centimeters high. ZB's silver emblem was embossed on the top of each one. Joseph took the first one off the shelf and put it on the table. He ran a sensor over it, which drew a complete blank. There was no detectable power source inside. If it was alarmed, they'd done it in a way he couldn't beat. He flipped the catch and opened the lid. His prime reported that the data pool remained silent. No alarm. The case contained 3 trays stacked on top of each other, each with 100 memory chips. He scanned them quickly, looking for the number they wanted. The Xianti flights for the next 5 days had already been scheduled, and their communication code assigned to them. He and Ray had chosen one in 4 days' time, which would give everyone else involved in the operation plenty of time to prepare and fly over from Memu Bay. He found the designated key in the 3rd case he opened. The little memory chip fit into the interface slot in his bracelet pearl, and the code transferred without a hitch. Joseph smiled broadly. That was it. The last major obstacle eliminated. Not that the rest of it was easy, but the odds of a successful completion had just risen considerably. So much was waiting behind this moment, so many awesome possibilities. He put the case back on the shelf exactly as he'd found it and left the vault. Simon Roderick waited patiently outside the elevators on sublevel 5. His D&I provided him with a simple audio channel to Adul, who was watching the screen in his office on the floor above. "He's closing the vault," Adul said. "Gadgets coming off the locks, putting them back in his pocket." Simon shifted his sensorium focus. The blue-gray corridor around him melted into hazier shadows. It was sliced by long, thin threads of brilliant emerald light, lurking just below every fuzzy surface. Some of them glowed with an intensity that rivaled the sun, while others were more delicate, flickering at frequencies almost too fast to notice. He was even aware of the little jade ember alight inside his own skull. The standard human senses of taste, touch, sight, smell, and hearing provide a phenomenal range of input for the brain to cope with. In most cases, it does so by subtly concentrating on one sense at a time, sliding the others into a peripheral mode. By using this inherent neural programming ability, geneticists reasoned that the sensorium could be expanded to cope with new inputs. The batches of Rodericks provided them with a perfect opportunity to experiment by adapting and modifying each fresh generation. The idea behind it, developing an ability to see electrical patterns, was an old one. Psychics, shamans, and con artists had been claiming they could find north for centuries, along with other mystical perceptual traits. The discovery of magnetite in human brain cells back in the late 20th century had bolstered their claims with the kind of pseudoscience backing such people thrived on. Given the minuscule quantities of magnetite actually involved, it was extremely unlikely that any of them could act as a human compass. In any case, there was no specific interface between the particles and the brain's neural tissue. That had to wait for genetic engineering to manipulate cells, incorporating magnetite particles into a ferrovesicle cell model. The actions of a magnetic field on the particles suspended in serous fluid were found to generate discernible neural impulses. After that, the alignment of the ferrovesicles to provide a valid image had to be determined, along with its size and how the impulses were best introduced into the brain. By the time the SK-2s were gestated, the design was essentially complete. Their electric sense organ took the form of a membranous crown with a nerve path direct into the medulla oblongata. It allowed them to see wires carrying current or data flow. But most important, and the reason the Rodericks wanted the ability in the first place, it allowed them to sense the impulses of another human brain. They were never going to be able to read thoughts directly, but by observing a brain in action, they could determine the emotional composition
See how much creativity was going into the thought processes, how much memory. As a lie detector, the pharovesical organ was almost infallible. In negotiations with the senior management of other companies, they had a profound advantage. "He's coming out," Adul said. Simon started walking forward. There were few other people in the corridor. He certainly couldn't risk clearing the building. That would have alerted Skett Magerson. Simon was already quite worried about the man's capabilities. The last thing he wanted was for this operation to degenerate into violence. He passed one man whose aura was bright and dense, barely distorted by his clothes. It corresponded to the contentment running through his brain. Another man was considerably dimmer, with areas resembling sunspots amid his emanations. Simon was experienced enough to spot a hangover without even having to ask any calibrating questions. Skett Magerson stepped out of the communications division. In the electromagnetic spectrum, he was a human nova. Simon almost stopped. He was so surprised at how bright the man's aura was. For a moment, he thought he might even be some kind of android. But no, the body's bioelectric patterns were all recognizably human, simply more intense by an order of magnitude. He also carried several electronic modules in his pockets. Tight flux lines pulsed around them, indicating high-level power cells. Simon didn't recognize any of them. It was hard to resolve anything through the vibrant electromagnetic glare, but the secondary patterns induced by the internal systems were fabulously complex and pervasive. He couldn't spot the usual signature of neurotronic pearls. When the two of them passed in the corridor, Skett Magerson's thoughts registered a small degree of nervousness, but nothing to indicate suspicion. Simon wondered what his own brain activity must reveal. If he'd known this was what he was up against, he would never have allowed himself to be in the same building as the refined man and his alien gadgetry. This discovery could well have a value greater than every asset realized on Thallspring. Where the hell did he come from, and what was causing that aura? One thing was for sure, this wasn't Skett Magerson, the pilot who was in ZB's files. "Sir?" Adul queried. "He might have weapons, but I'm not sure. Proceed as planned." Joseph pressed for an elevator. It took a few seconds to arrive. He resisted the impulse to shout at the slow old mechanism to hurry. "I did it!" Walked into ZB's most secure facility and stole their crown jewels. Their last remaining problem would be to get the Dragon through spaceplane cargo security. He and Raymond had already developed ideas about that. The elevator doors opened. A man came out, giving Joseph a distracted nod. Joseph stood to one side, then walked in. He pressed for the first sublevel. The doors closed, and the elevator began to rise. A quick change of identity back to Andal Pine and the toilets. Maybe 30 minutes after that, he'd be back in the car and away from the spaceport. His de-written neural cells lost all contact with the administration block network. How could that happen? He frowned, but the lights were still on and the elevator still moving. Maybe the elevator was somehow isolating him from the node. But it hadn't happened on the way down. Joseph blinked as he swayed against the wall. The control panel with its buttons and illuminated floor display wavered as if he were looking at it through water. What the fuck is this? He jabbed the emergency stop button. Nothing happened. The elevator was still moving. His legs sagged, taking him down to his knees. Blotches danced across his vision. There was no air. He drew down a deep breath, but it made no difference. His strength was fading fast. Air. He had to have air. He called up what strength he could and punched at the door where the two halves sealed in the middle. The metal buckled under his fist. It was smeared with blood. He punched it again, and the dent deepened. There was no gap between. Another punch. This one had no effect. He didn't even hear the bang of the impact. His forehead was resting against the door. It wasn't cold. He couldn't feel anything. His last conscious thought was directed at the prime stored in his bracelet pearl. Help. That evening, they asked Hal if he wanted a priest in the morning.
He told them to go and fuck themselves with a skinned dick. They asked what he wanted for his last meal. He said a boiled egg. After that, they left him alone. Dawn was at 5:22. At 4:30, Lawrence and Dennis came to visit. Hal was being kept in one of the cellars under the Barnsdale Hotel. Two skins were on permanent guard outside the tough wooden door, and the master-at-arms had fitted Hal with a remote restraint bracelet, just in case. Nobody was really expecting any trouble. The skins got a call alerting them to Lawrence's arrival a minute before he turned up. He and Dennis were pushing a small hotel kitchen trolley along in front of them. "But he didn't want a meal," one of the skins said. "I know," Lawrence said, "but we brought it anyway. It's a filet steak, his favorite." He took the silver top off a plate so the skin could see. "Okay, then. You'd better go in." Hal was lying on the small cot in the corner of the room, hands behind his head. He looked around when Lawrence and Dennis rattled the trolley across the floor. "I told them I didn't want any of that crap." "The chef's a local," Lawrence said, "and the guilt's starting to sink in. If we go back and tell him he left it under the grill too long, he'll probably need therapy for the rest of his life. You know what a pain these liberals are." Hal grinned and went over to the trolley. The guard shut the door. "Sarge," Hal said quietly, "I know what you said, but I've been thinking. I want to take the injection. It doesn't hurt none, and it'll be just like going to sleep. I figure that's for the best, you know?" "Hal, I need you to face the firing squad. I'm sorry. I know it's going to be tough, the toughest it could ever get for anyone. But that's the only way." "Only way for what?" Dennis bent down and pulled the trolley's white linen cloth aside. There was a field aid case on the lower shelf. "What's that for?" Hal asked. "A simple way out of this mess," Lawrence said, "which is the only thing that worries me. Someone else might figure this out." "Sit down, Hal." Hal did as he was told. Dennis put the case down beside him and opened it up. He unwound two coils of clear, thin tubing and plugged them into Hal's neck valves. "Now listen," Lawrence said, and started to explain. It was uncharacteristically cold for Memu Bay as the first traces of wan pre-dawn light skimmed eagerly over the horizon. Miles Hazeldine had put on a warm woolen coat to accompany every Zhang out into the orchard garden at the back of the Barnsdale Hotel. The orchard had been selected because it was enclosed by a tall stone wall. Miles assumed ZB wanted to keep the execution private from the morbidly curious local citizens. But Zhang had told him the wall would also help stop the bullets. It had taken a moment for Miles to understand what he meant. "A firing squad?" the horrified mayor had asked. He couldn't believe that even ZB was this barbaric. Like the rest of Memu Bay, he'd assumed they'd simply administer an overdose of some sedative, that Grabowski would quietly slip from sleep into death, and that would be the end of it. He should have known better. This whole terrible event was never going to finish with quiet dignity. Now he was going to have to stand and watch as bullets tore into a man with an explosion of blood. It was an outrage against civilized decency. He couldn't even feel glad that Grabowski was going to die like this. He'd wanted justice, certainly, but this was more like medieval vengeance. "The condemned man does have this right," Zhang had explained awkwardly. "There are three methods of execution, and he can select one. If he doesn't, the court will decide for him. It is unusual to ask for firing squad." There was a thin line of perspiration on Zhang's forehead, despite the early morning chill. Miles didn't ask what the third method was. He followed Zhang to a place at the rear of the orchard garden. His eyes never left the single post that had been set into the ground in front of the far wall. The earth was fresh around its base. Sandbags were stacked up behind it. This was everything his ancestors had left Earth for, the ultimate act of callous inhumanity. Miles jammed his shaking hands into his pockets and looked at the grass. "Think of Francine," he ordered himself sternly. "The terror she went through." Someone was barking out orders. Miles forced his head up. The sergeant major marched
the 8-strong firing squad out of the door and halted them behind the line, painted on the grass, 7 meters away from the post. The unlucky squaddies had been chosen by the old short straw draw. He'd spoken with each of them beforehand, telling them that Grabowski would want someone who could shoot straight and clean, and they were not to let him down no matter their feelings, assuring them that this duty would never go on their record. When they left the briefing, sullen and subdued, he'd quietly thanked Allah that he wouldn't actually be pulling a trigger himself. Then Lawrence Newton slipped in and had a quiet word. The sergeant major had listened to his old comrade's request and nodded agreement. Anything else he didn't want to know about. Edmund Orloff and Corporal Amersey led the condemned man out into the orchard. Hal showed no emotion as they stopped him by the post. Edmund tied his wrists together behind the post and whispered something to his friend. A smile played over Hal's lips. Amersey offered him a blindfold, which he accepted. The two men from Platoon 435 NK9 saluted their comrade and marched away. The sergeant major looked to Every Zhang, who gave a slight nod. Squad, raise your weapons. The sound of palms slapping precisely against weapons carried across the orchard. Take aim. Hey, Zhang, Hal called out. You are one miserable fuck-up of a commander, man. Fire. Miles Hazeldine threw up. The sound of 8 rifles firing at once had stunned him. It suspended time in silence. Then he casually turned his head and saw Grabowski's body shudder as it was thrown back against the post. Blood burst out of his chest with frightening speed, and the big young man was falling, slumping forward onto his knees with only his bound hands holding his ruined torso up. Sound returned to Miles's universe, a roaring in his ears. A human being had been slaughtered in front of him. Because of him, the deal he'd cut. He knelt forward and vomited helplessly onto the orchard's dew-moistened grass. Traditionally, they were called the burial detail, though on Fall Spring there would never be any grave dug for a member of Xantiu Braun. Company policy governing death away from Earth was for a cremation and scattering of the ashes. Hal Grabowski's own platoon had demanded the right to perform that last duty, and Captain Bryant certainly wasn't going to try to say no. He really didn't need any open rebellion among his own men right now. So, while the firing squad was marched quickly away, they walked out of the hotel with a stretcher and a body bag. They untied Hal's hands as Every Zhang was supporting the retching mayor and laid their dead friend out on the blood-soaked grass. He was lifted gently into the body bag, which was zipped up, then transferred onto the stretcher. They carried him away as the mayor and the senior officers went back into the hotel. The cleanup detail emerged after that to take down the post and remove the sandbags. There was blood to be washed away, too. By mid-morning, there would be no trace left of the execution. The burial detail carried the stretcher through the rear corridors of the hotel and out into the small courtyard used by delivery trucks. A van was waiting there to take the body to the crematorium. Its doors were opened quickly and the stretcher pushed inside. Had anyone managed to see the interior, they would have been surprised to see how much medical equipment was inside. It could almost have been mistaken for an ambulance. Go, Lawrence yelled at Lewis. The van sped out of the courtyard. Dennis was already ripping the body bag open. Oh, hell, the medic grunted when he saw the mess of gore that was Hal's chest. How many bullets? Only 3, Lawrence said. He caught sight of the body. Sweet mother of fate, can you do it? Dennis was already activating Hal's skin suit, which lay crumpled in the corner of the van. He brought the extension tubes out and began plugging them into the kid's valves. Cut the shirt off. Blood began to squirt out of the jagged wounds, pouring onto the floor of the van. Lawrence took a scalpel and sliced the shirt fabric, pulling the saturated cloth aside, leaving room for Dennis to work. When he brought his hands away, they were dripping blood. For the first time, he began to have doubts. Something he hadn't acknowledged before. He refused to let doubt be part of the equation as he focused himself on accomplishing just one thing, not letting the bastards murder Hal. He wanted a victory over Killboy as subtle and devious as Killboy's relentless assault against the platoons on the streets of Mimu Bay. but now he could actually see the terrible damage that the bullets had caused. Dennis was trying to clamp off the torn arteries in the chest cavity. His heart's so much raw meat, we'll have to drain and reinflate the lungs. The brain? Lawrence demanded. What about the brain? I don't know. Dennis gave him an anguished look. It was 7 minutes. His optronic membranes were scrolling medical data almost too quickly for him to follow. Hal's skin was using up its drug capsules at a dangerous rate as it tried to minimize cellular trauma. But we superoxygenated his blood, Lawrence said. You said that would last him. It should. It should. Dennis finished clamping one artery and went for the next. Odell, anything? Odell was attaching a sensor to Hal's scalp. He looked at a palm-top display. Not yet. Still flatlined. Come on, Dennis screamed at the kid. His face was streaked with Hal's blood, which he'd smeared there with the back of his hand. Lewis, how long till we get there? Lawrence shouted. 3 minutes, Sarge. Is he alive? I don't know, Dennis barked. 3 minutes, Dennis, that's all. The crash team's waiting. Crash team? Dennis's voice was veering toward hysteria. Crash team? One struck-off doctor and a couple of field medics, and you expect them to perform a fucking heart transplant? It's a biomech heart, Dennis. You just plug it in and switch it on.